All right, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'll preface my remarks. I do not have any background in the justice area. Most of my work is actually government-wide. I specialize at the Center for Evaluation Methods and Issues in trying to further program evaluation across the federal government. And so we do that through a variety of studies of agency evaluation activities, use of different kinds of methods for addressing various analytical problems, and then we do a lot of outreach. So this is part of that, and what I wanted to do was, before I actually talk about our report, I wanted to, because I don't want to presume that the answer to the question, what is rigorous evidence, is only what I'm going to be talking about today. And in our report, but rather in terms of prime uses of research and evaluation in program management, I would push hard for in all program management that you'd be using performance monitoring and environmental scans to find out what's going on around you in the context that your program is operating so you keep up to date, and use process and outcome evaluations to find out how to improve your program over time. And then there's a question, particularly at the federal level, about making large, broad, based decisions for national programs. What do we want other people to adopt, right, as opposed to managing your own program? And that's when we start getting to these questions about rigorous evidence of a program impact that I'm going to spend most of my time on. As Phelan was talking, and already, you know, spoke to this issue about big pressure on trying to get more and improve government performance with more information about what works, right? Also, as they've started reviewing the evaluation evidence for some of the federal programs, they got very disappointed at the quality of a vast majority of the program evaluations that they've seen. And so there's been push for more rigorous evaluation, and in particularly there's been a push for more experimental methods to improve the estimates of program impact, right? And where this comes from, and I'm assuming everybody has a certain amount of research background, but not a lot, okay? So the basic assumption, why would you use random assignment? Well, when we're trying to assess whether any of our social programs work, we often use a method that actually started back in agricultural research and has adopted in medicine and is adopted to some extent, but is not as much in the social services. Is we're trying to control, we know that the outcomes we're looking for are influenced by a wide variety of other factors outside the program, okay? All the really interesting stuff, right, that happens is not completely controlled by our programs. Get past the IRS debt collection, right? And so the idea is that we're going to look at the experience of people who are in the program or are receiving the treatment and those who did not receive the treatment, look at their results at the end and see if they're different. Now, if we randomly assign them to those comparison groups, there shouldn't be anything significantly different between those groups except their exposure to this program. So then your deduction at the end is, well, if we see a difference in their outcomes at the end of our study, it must be the result of that program. Okay, that's the logic we're working with. Now, in pushes to try to focus federal funds on effective programs, the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, which is a nonprofit group, had suggested what they call a top-tier initiative to review evaluation evidence to identify those interventions that were really, really strong, the ones that have been tested with experimental designs and found to have strong outcomes. Okay, Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee then requested GAO, us, to examine this top-tier evidence initiative. How is that working? And specifically, they said, well, what about this criteria of only those being found effective in randomized controlled experiments? Is that too narrow? What kinds of interventions would be best suited for that kind of criterion, And what types of interventions would not actually be, would this be a good criteria for, okay? And then effectively, what else could we, what other methods could we use, right? Okay, that's, the latter is what I'm going to talk about today. We went about this essentially by reviewing the evaluation methods literature. Okay, we've got decades of people talking about this problem and summarized it in terms of, however, what kinds of programs or interventions. Interventions is a tighter name about it's like what specific activities. Okay, and then did a summary and then worked with evaluation experts, senior folks, to review what we'd come to summarize and give us a sense of, are we capturing sort of the consensus view? The first thing that you come up with, first point all of them made, is that you wouldn't be looking at an effectiveness evaluation at all unless the intervention is important and you actually want to know whether it's worth somebody else adopting it, right? It's got to be clearly defined so we know what it is and what it isn't, and well implemented so we don't make the mistake of saying, oh, well, we tested it and then find out that it actually was never put in place in the first place. They just said they had, okay? And thirdly, the study needs to be adequately resourced because some of the problem with the evaluation literature is that we have not spent enough resources to make sure that we got credible evidence, that we got, let's say, good survey responses, and so there were lots of questions left at the end of the study. This is a waste of resources. We don't have that many program evaluation resources, frankly, in the federal government, to be spending it on studies that are not sufficiently well done to provide a conclusive answer. Okay. The next point is, it actually has to be a program where we need to worry about this external factors business. Like I said, there are some programs like IRS debt collection. It's really pretty simple. You know, we want them to collect the right monies from the right people and do it in a reasonable period of time. Those are not the programs we're talking about. We're talking about the ones where we're trying to influence human behavior usually. And there's a lot of other factors going on besides our program, okay? Now we've passed those hurdles. Random assignment is absolutely considered very strong design when it's possible, practical, and ethical. First issue is the evaluator needs to control exposure to the intervention. We can't have people volunteering because we don't know if there's something different between those who volunteer and those who don't. The evaluator, in order to do this random assignment, we have to control who's exposed to the program. Second, there's got to be limited coverage of the population so we have somebody left over who's not receiving the intervention, who's not in the program. This sounds so obvious, right? The comparison groups have to be kept separate and distinct throughout the study. This is important, particularly in social interventions, because we're often working with knowledge, attitudes that are affecting behavior. Sometimes the people who have learned that they're in the special new program behave differently because they perceive themselves differently and they perceive what they're actually experiencing a little differently. You want to keep out these other reasons why we might see differences at the end of the study, right? So we usually want to keep them apart and we want to make sure that the comparison group is not going out and getting the same services from somebody else out in the community, okay? And outcomes have to be observed within a reasonable time frame. This is the practical issue, right? If you have to wait a long time to see these outcomes occur later, several years later in people's lives, you're going to have to follow them all that time, right? So you're talking expense. Okay. Thinking about the programs that you just flip that on the other side, you can start to see some of the issues. Entitlement programs. These are pensions. veterans benefits and the like. Every single person who is eligible for those benefits must receive them. We cannot make decisions about withholding those, okay? Similarly, laws that prescribe particular activities occur or not occur. We cannot selectively apply those laws and randomly assign some people to be exposed to them and other people not to be. Okay. You're thinking of state laws, yes, but I can't randomly assign which legislator will pass which version of those laws, right? We can make comparisons, but not random assignment. Broadcast media, radio, TV, internet, right? We don't control who's exposed. You, the participants, turn on the radio. Turn it off when you hear that stupid message again, right? You skip over the ads and the other things. You have control over whether you're exposed to those messages, right? The evaluator isn't. Comprehensive social reforms are occurred in the last 10, 15 years. It's an effort to say what we want to do is have a variety of multiple interventions and activities going on in a community to try to change some of the relationships, perhaps between institutions or between people in the neighborhood and their institutions. And what you're trying to do is initiate a variety of organic activity. This is very hard to control, identify, and randomize, therefore. So it's not a good choice for the randomization. Negative events, and this is, you know, beyond we can't control hurricanes. We also are usually not allowed to expose people to a real substantive risk of harm just to find out whether our preventive or remedial programs are effective. We have to wait for those negative events to occur. Random assignment is also not practical in a variety of settings. In the welfare area where I've spent a lot of my time, you'll find staff, and this also happens in education, where you're talking about needy populations that needs particular services, staff will be very unwilling to deny services to people who they believe deserve them. So what you have to do is try to play with maybe alternative services or things like that. You have to work hard in some of those situations. It can be done, but it's going to be difficult. Rare events and long time lags. Rare events is the same kind of problem. You've got to have large sample sizes in order to get statistically significant differences. It is possible. That's not the problem. The problem is expensive. So if we've already decided this is an important question to understand, that we really get a good estimate of the effectiveness of these interventions, then by all means, spend the money. But don't do it hoping that, you know, you can do it on the cheap. And finally, the broad flexible programs. For us at the federal level, this is a big issue. With a lot of the what we call formula or block grants, where we actually encourage localities to all be using different services, treat different populations, it makes it very difficult now to try to arrange a randomized trial experiment. So, but there are alternatives. We are not painted into a box saying that we can't do anything else. We can. And there are a variety of rigorous methods that are available. I am going to do a very quick cartoon picture of the standard ones. By all means, read our report and go through any major texts and look for help to get more details. The first is obvious, is you have a non-randomized comparison group. That is, you often have a new intervention that is being tested out someplace. And you're selecting people from the rest of the population who look as similar as possible to these folks in order to try to deal with that problem. Is there anything substantially different between them to begin with? You have to be very careful and check all the baseline characteristics beforehand and the like. Regression discontinuity analysis is not as common. It's very powerful design. Here, we actually are assigning people into two groups, not randomly, though, but deliberately. We use a pretest, a baseline measure that is quantitative, and say everybody below a certain score will be in the program receiving services, and everybody above it will not. Okay? This gets at that I don't want to withhold services from my needy population problem. Then what you do is you just analyze the data on the people right around the cutoff, because frankly they're pretty similar. They're very similar compared to everybody who was brought in. Now the catch is this is very expensive. You're going to throw out the data on the rest of the group. So, but it is very powerful. Alternatively, you have statistical analysis of observational data. We don't have control over who's exposed at all. So what we do is we measure their exposure to the program. When you think of dosage in medicine, it's like, you know, how much violence on TV do you watch? Those kinds of studies, right? And then we also measure the outcome variable on those people, and we correlate to see if there's a relationship between the extent and whether or not there's exposure to the program, and then whether that's related to the outcomes. Okay. You're going to be using other statistical analysis to make sure there aren't any other differences associated with that exposure choice, right? To see if that might not be explaining. You got more statistical analysis to do than in the randomized trials. Interrupted time series analysis is like performance monitoring. You're collecting data on an outcome for a period of time before a policy change, which occurs to everybody, okay? Like those law changes. Big moment in time, and then watch the data change afterwards or not, right? Okay. Long series, you're usually using administrative data. You're probably doing some other statistical analyses to deal with the waviness. Maybe there's time cycles that, you know, that deal with in your outcome variable. And finally, for that really tough one on the comprehensive reforms where everything's going on and you really don't have control over it, the best people could come up with, because they really can't find a good comparison site, is to use an in-depth case study. And beforehand, that's critical, beforehand, predict what changes you expect to see, both in the operations of the programs, the way they relate to individuals, what kinds of outcome behavior changes you want to see. List all that out beforehand, where, who, etc. And then as that program starts developing, map it. Measure all of those process and outcomes and see if they match what your hypothesis was. Okay. Now, there are, of course, other rigorous methods, but basically what we're talking about, using those main designs, you can do a lot more to what we're after is trying to isolate the impact of that particular program effect. Okay. Basically, you're collecting more data. Okay, more data, assembling more evidence to rule out all those alternative hypotheses that could be explaining a difference or a change in outcome behaviors. Okay, so both baseline data, targeted comparisons. There's often, what about all the dropouts? Okay, the people who dropped out of the program early, what were their results afterwards? What about... It's even better if it's because of a program administrative problem that one office shut down and didn't enroll as well. What happened to that office's participants or clients? Basically, you want to gather a diverse body of evidence. What we do not want to encourage is relying on a single study. Right? This is a problem. A single study is a moment in time, a particular set of people in a particular moment, in a particular place. It's only a sample of all the occurrences that you might expect under this program, and you're worrying about trying to encourage everybody to do it this way. You want more data, okay? So you want more. You want to see it in different settings with different populations, right? And you might actually learn it may be robust, but it may be robust for certain kinds of people, right? It's important to know that. Okay. Our basic observations from the study. As you may have guessed by now, we definitely believe that simply requiring evidence from randomized controlled trials alone would not be a good idea if you really want to identify the full set of effective practices. You're going to miss some. Secondly, frankly, I think most people in the field are not thinking only of effectiveness when they decide what kinds of policies they're going to adopt. They want to know what the cost is. They want to know what other kinds of resources they need to have in order to implement this. They're going to want to know whether this type of program is going to be accepted by their community. That's a big one. It's not effectiveness alone. And then finally, from GAO, it's like, for those of us, we review tons of evaluations. We would know, generally, GAO, government-wide, even nationwide, we would know a lot more if we had better designed and implemented evaluations, if we had better reporting of what people did in the study, and also, particularly, what did the comparison group experience? That often is not described very well. And more evaluations that actually directly compare alternatives that you're considering, right? You're not considering, you know, a new program of services versus no services. You're saying, I'd like to know, should I do it this way or that way? So you'd like to see evaluations that directly compare them. Okay. To sum up, here's the this first one is the title of the report with a report number, and I was thinking I was going to make handouts and I didn't have time, sorry. But essentially, if you go to the GAO website and you look for reports and publications, they'll have a little space and you can just type in the number, GAO 1030, and it'll pop up for you in PDF form. I want to make a pitch for a couple other documents. One is I'm on a task force with the AEA, American Evaluation Association, and we had last spring written up a little white paper that describes the kinds of good practices, key elements for federal agencies to have in their evaluation capacity in order to actually integrate that into government management and improve programs. And so I would like to sell that here. And so if you go to the eval.org, the economists beat us to AEA, and look up the roadmap for the Evaluation Policy Task Force, you will find it. Okay. Also, I'm involved with an informal network of federal evaluators, folks from all over the federal government. And on our website, fedeval.net, we actually have lists of resources on program evaluation, agency websites, GAO reports, books that we really enjoy and think are really good texts and sources and the like. Okay, so you can look there. It's not updated very often, but you know some of this stuff is classic. Okay, and here's how you can find me at shipmaness@gao.gov. Okay, thanks.